Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I have Jason Healy, a senior research scholar at Columbia University, and we are discussing his latest paper entitled Building a Defensible Cyberspace. So here at the Loopcast, we wanted to... we stopped for a while, and then we're re-upping again on cybersecurity, the intersection of cybersecurity and policy. Because I think for multiple reasons, obviously... the most obvious reason is that when you discuss cybersecurity, I think we tend to default to the glossiest, sexiest version of it. You know, Stuxnet, Russians, Chinese hacking, U.S. hacking, the NSA, as opposed to getting into sort of the nitty-gritty of what is cybersecurity policy? What does it look like from the top down? And then the second part of that is it's... You know, compared to other sort of policies that are out there in D.C., cybersecurity is relatively new. And we wanted to just, you know, start this conversation with people who are not only practitioners, but policymakers, and, you know, get their ideas and opinions on this topic. So please welcome Jason Healy. So I want to maybe start off with a historical question in that when we... Our last conversation was in 2012, 2013, I think. It's years ago. and then in the cybersecurity realm, you know, it almost feels like decades ago. But I want to maybe have you sort of describe the period from 2013 to 2017 for us in just broad historical terms. And then we'll get into this discussion of policy and then the paper.
Yeah, when last we talked, it was around the time when my book came out. It was called A Fierce Domain, and it was a history of cyber conflict from 1986 to 2012. And it covered that period because 1986 was clearly the first cyber conflict, which I thought was obviously an incident called the Cuckoo's Egg, which was a Soviet KGB espionage operation. And we said it started in 1986 because it had all of these dynamics. Right? You had the defender, a guy named Klystol, the difficulty trying to trace back. He had to invent things like honeypot to try and keep the bad guy in his system. And the basic dynamics of the interaction between the attacker and the defender are extremely the same if you're looking at an APT-1 or APT-34 kind of incident today. And we looked at a few different phases that cyber conflict had gone through, you know, kind of from exploration into the period from 2003 or so onward was, you know, professionalization, and then we called it militarization, where you saw that increasingly it being a national security space. You know, the concern was less about, ooh, those hackers, we wave our fist at the hackers, to wow, no, the military is really taking this seriously. And that the period from 2012 onward has really been even scarier than we thought it was going to be. You know, the trend that I talked about at the end of that book was we're going to see this increasing transport militarization. We're going to see it's going to get increasingly more dangerous. No one had died of a cyber attack. We said that's probably going to be changing as we look forward. And unfortunately, I think those trends have probably been even worse than we thought. We've hit the point where someone's died from a cyber attack with WannaCry, right, with affecting National Health Service in the UK, where someone might have died, maybe not directly, like the pacemaker stuff, but certainly the postponing surgeries. And... if there's anything that catches me in 2012, it's been the intrusion of, well, one is the increasing audacity of how adversaries use these capabilities. I was at a conference the other day, and the general that runs Army Cyber Command said that he thought the drivers for cyber conflict were people and technology, and boy, that doesn't seem right to me. It seems to me that it's the audacity of adversaries that's driving cyber conflict. And also, one of the big changes has been, one isn't audacity. 2002 is we finally had national security significant cyber incidents. In 2012, it was easy for me to write and say, it's easy, we can to some degree, you can dismiss cyber because you haven't had any national security significant incidents yet. Easy to say that in 2012. Shamoon, Stuxnet, I mean, yeah, those were important, but they weren't of the scale of things that we normally, when we think about national security significant incidents, certainly against the U.S., and now at the hacking of the DNC, we certainly crossed that line. And that hits of cyber finally crossing into these resounding, echoing national security incidents that will be with us for a long time. But, and this is the third point, the cyber incidents have been important in a different way than we thought in 2012. Since around 2003, the military forgot about information operations and influence, and they were only focusing on these cybers, you know, and the actual direct impact of the hack. And it turns out in the last couple of years that some of the most important national security cyber incidents have been less important to the cyber aspect of it than what happened with the information. You know, look at Sony. It was a doxing incident. Look at what was happened with DNC. It wasn't the hack that was particularly interesting from a national security standpoint. It was what happened with the information afterwards.
So I want to maybe switch footing and go from history to policy. And I'm going to ask this in maybe twofold. And what do you see as the ideal role for policy, like policymakers? But then also, contrast that with what has been the reality of policymakers sort of engaging in this space.
Yeah, so right now I'm with, I'll answer that in two ways. So right now I'm with Columbia University, the School of International Public Affairs here. So I'm in public policy, right? I'm trying to train people that are going to go out and do public policy, and we're looking at what we can do better in public policy. We just finished a New York Cyber Task Force. A report came out in end of September, where we had a lot of the CISOs from around New York. Some people had been former policymakers. People co-chaired by Phil Venables, Greg Rattray of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, my dean here at SEPA, a woman named Merit Jaina, a former trade official. And we looked at what can we do to get cyberspace more defensible. And the heart of that was, if you go to the report of the brochure, if you just look for New York Cyber Task Force, defensible cyberspace in your favorite search engine, the center two pages of the report is we look back over 50 years, what are the innovations that have helped make cyberspace more defensible? So, and we break that into the innovations from technology, from operations, and from policy, and those that operate within the enterprise and across cyberspace as a whole. So the top left part of that chart is technology within the enterprise. That's where most of our experience is, right? This is, it starts with passwords and firewalls and intrusion detection systems. You know, it's the stuff that we buy, we purchase, we deploy. That's where most of our measurement is. If we're getting pressure from our boards or from others to do stuff, that's where most of our attention is focused. Go to RSA conference or any other major conferences. That's where most of the solutions are going to be technology inside the enterprise. As a public policy guy, That's the part I care about least. I'm much more interested in, for example, technology across the across cyberspace as a whole, because that's where I get real leverage. Even the best technology that only operates within the enterprise, I've got to make sure it gets deployed a billion times correctly to really make sure that we're going to get leverage out of that. Compare that to technology that operates across cyberspace as a whole. When we were talking to experts in the field, without a doubt, they said the most important innovation that we have ever done was things like Windows Update. It wasn't necessarily cheap or easy for Microsoft to do Windows Update. But once we did it, you took users out of the solution by just automatically updating. We were, instead of having to do the same thing a billion times, we did it once and it would be repeated a billion times. It's getting the massive scale of the internet to aid the defenders rather than the attackers. We also found, and I'll finish, I'll take a pause after this, that we tend to overlook the operational innovations. We had to invent computer emergency response teams in 1988 after the Morris worm, this worm that took down 10% of the internet. We had to invent information sharing and analysis centers in the 90s. We're really pushing that we need to do more of this operational level collaboration and innovation to do things. Policy is where we've got the least experience. It's hardest to measure it. It's more likely to create winners and losers. But it's really through the operational and the public policy that we think we're going to get much more significant gains in cyber in the next couple of years.
So with that, I want to maybe discuss your paper, Building a Defensive, excuse me, Defensible Cyberspace. And I want to start off with maybe defining the problem space, sort of, who are the players, what is the medium, who are the players, and sort of, describing the problem space as you see it, and then we'll parse it down and look at the individual parts.
And so if I can phrase the go back in the problem statement, because I mentioned that cyber conflict history book, A Fierce Domain, that we talked about last time. My favorite quote from that book that I did as I was researching that book was, and maybe your regular listeners will catch on to the quote, it was, "Few, if any, contemporary computer security controls can stop a dedicated red team from easily accessing any information sought." So I suspect many of your listeners will know a red team is when you're in cyber is when you're paying a team of friendly hackers to try and break into your system so that they can test the security. So this quote is saying those guys are always going to get, they're pretty much always going to get through. And it's a truism today. If you go to RSA conference or any of the other major conferences, you'll hear that again and again in vendor talks and others. But what it's essentially saying is that the attacker will always get through, that the attacker has the advantages in cyberspace. And what really got me depressed about that quote was from 1979.
Holy
And
crap.
so, yeah, so essentially since 1979, when I say this in front of audience, I say, why the hell does anybody listen to us? Why does anybody listen to us cybersecurity experts? I used to say we're the Chicago Cubs of the Internet, but I can't say that anymore, right? Since 1979, the tens of billions of people of dollars that people have spent because of our recommendations, the hundreds and thousands of patents, the thousands of companies that we've created, the millions of weekends that we've missed in kids' birthday parties and soccer games and plays, right? All of that has been at best to break even. And right now, if you talk to most cyber defenders, they don't think we're breaking even. They think the attackers are still gaining ground, or they're still running away from us even faster. So it comes down to why we've got to do something differently, right? If we just keep thinking we're going to do more of the same, it's just crap. It hasn't worked since 1979, and there's no reason to believe that we're smarter, or that we're putting more money, or that we've got better concepts than what we've been doing. So that's why for this report, we said we've got to look across this: technology, operations, policy. We have got to make sure that the things that we do give us the most defense advantage, the most advantage to the defenders, at the greatest scale, at the least cost. And it's shocking how much, like, you'd think that makes sense, right? Yeah, we do the stuff that gives us an advantage, right? And it's amazing that that's actually not true. How much we do things like checklist compliant, how much we do, we deploy things only because we've always done it that way, or the regulators say that we have to do it that way. So what we were really trying to get across in this report was trying to look back historically at where we've gotten the most defense advantage and then saying, all right, here's the kind of stuff that we ought to do next and we'll get the most defense advantage.
I'm sort of curious, when we do look at the offense, what specifically is giving them the advantage? Because, I mean, when
That's a great question, yeah.
I mean, when we... Oh, God, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, when we discuss offense, it seems like there's such a range of actors. Like, so, you know, going from ransomware sort of proprietors to APT. So, I mean, you know, is when we describe the offense and its advantages, are we talking about, you know, specific actors and methods, or are we talking about, like, you know, sort of a Venn diagram of where, you know, phishing, you know, exploit writing, etc.?
It's a great question. Thanks. Because it's one of the most important things that we didn't have time to follow up in this report, and now that I think about it, we've got a little bit of money left over, and I might try and do this, because ours was defense-focused, and we said, here's the stuff that's given the defense the most advantage. Dmitry Alperovich, who many of your listeners might know, he's the co-founder of a group called CrowdStrike, and he's always trying to push the what do things look like in the adversary's perspective. And so in the report, we did this a little bit, but not much, as we would have liked, of saying, well, so if these technology operations and policies have most helped the defense, what are the technologies, the operations and operational innovations and policies that have most helped the attackers? And so on the technology side, you've got, there were a lot of things around, for example, point and click hacking, right? I mean, when I get into this business in the 90s, you know, everything was command line, right? And you had to have a pretty high level of knowledge to be able to hack. You know, it was you were typing all of the commands. And by the, you know, late 90s and into the early 2000s, right, you had much more GUIs on that. You had more point and click. Now you've got things like Metasploit and these other tools that make hacking incredibly easy, even if you don't have significant skills. And so that's some of the technology path. On the operational innovations, right, on the defensive side, you had operational innovations like creating information sharing organizations. On the attacker side, you had innovations like Carter markets and cybercrime as a service. Right, you had these specializations where different parts of the criminal underworld would specialize, and they would have escrow services and the rest, so that you would have honor among thieves, if you will, so that way they could scale really well and scale better, operational concepts that allowed them to scale better than the defenders could scale. On the policy side, whereas the defenders would have policies like presidential directives that would, you know, say, here's going to be a new cyber threat intelligence organization, or here's how, that, you know, directing the FBI to share whenever they know that American company's been hacked. On the defensive, on the attacker side, they had policy innovations like sanctuaries, like agreements between the state and hacker groups that as long as you don't hack anything in our country and you only hack the Americans, then you're going to be fine and we're not going to bother you. And you saw that in Eastern Ukraine, you saw that in Russia, you saw that to some degree in China. And so it's a great question, and I think we'll try and do some follow-up work on that.
Interesting. So, I mean, my last question on the offense is, you know, does the offense sort of, do they do management innovations? Because it almost seems like in order to go from typical crime and sort of ransomware production to, you know, organized APT level activity, that it's not about technology, it's about sort of evolving, you know, sort of a management or sort of bureaucratic support. So I know for defense, we obviously have a lot of bureaucracy and management, but on the offense, I mean, do you see management innovations, bureaucratic innovations, or is it really just about hacking and sort of, lowering the barrier to be effective, via, hacking, so to speak.
Yeah, and there was a lot of work by, probably some of the first times I was reading was Derek Mankey and others back in 2013, where they were talking about cybercrime as a service, right? So we're almost 5 years into this. Of you'd see these specializations, trust models, these ways that the hackers could come together. I don't want to say hackers is the wrong term to use here. Or the cyber criminals would come together in different ways to monetize their business, right? Maybe it started with the Carter markets and these websites where you could sell credit cards, and then they had to, they would do innovations like, all right, we'll give you a couple numbers free so you can try them out and make sure that the numbers are good, and we'll have escrow services. So that way, you can make sure you're going to be that this is going to be this is going to be safe. Rating system. That hey, I'm a 4.9 stars in the kinds of credit card numbers that stolen credit card numbers and credentials that I give you. So a lot of the things that that we developed on in cyberspace for commerce. They were taking those innovations for commerce and using them for a crime against that commerce. And that's better than what the defenders did, right? The defenders, we tended to have classification and trust models that were built around personally knowing the other people that you were dealing with so that you could be good to share. And so theirs, because they were built on models of commerce rather than models of paranoid security, cautious security, they tended to scale much better on the criminal side than we did on the defense.
So with that in mind, I want to maybe switch over to describing the defenders, because it seems like to me that defense is so much more complex, because I feel like, not only do you have the technological innovations, monitoring, logging, firewalls, etc., but you also have a distinctly human problem. So the anecdote from my day job, it was basically like we had to teach people how not to get phished or what to look for. And when discussing that, that problem, not getting phished, it wasn't even technological. The conversation we had with people wasn't even technological. It was not paranoia, but critical thinking. Did you really receive an email from Amazon Rewards, et cetera? And I use that to describe because the defense seems, it entails so much. So, I mean,
yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's where we're really in this paper trying to push. We've got to do the things that are going to work at the greatest scale at the least cost, and that gives the most defense advantage. Because if we're only operating in that upper left area of technology that operates in the enterprise, then most of those solutions add complexity. And that gets, as you say, right? I mean, even as someone that's working in this business, I find it very difficult to try and keep myself fully secure, or not fully secure, but, right, I mean, the amount of things that you have to do and the amount of complexity, even if just for you as a person, much less for a large-scale enterprise, a sector, a nation, or cyberspace as a whole. So you're right, that's incredibly, incredibly difficult. So the recommendations that push are where can we get the simplest solutions that are going to be effective? So many of your listeners that are listening, especially if they're within Washington, D.C., might be surprised how much we recommend cloud computing and cloud storage. I've spent enough time in D.C. that all of the conversations around cloud go, yes, but. Yes, it's a great technology and you can save costs, but it is not really particularly secure, and you've got to be very cautious. We had some of the best chief information security officers in the business, Phil Venable from Goldman Sachs, Ed Amoroso from AT&T, and their conversation, so when they were talking about cloud, I'm waiting, like, oh, man, they're talking about cloud, man, this is going to be, they're going to get snapped. And the conversation in this group was all yes and. Yes, this is amazing technology, and we haven't even begun to see the security benefits of it yet. Now, it's not risk-free. You can't just go to the cloud and imagine that you're going to be secure. It takes time and motivation to do it correctly. But the risks that you're buying with cloud are much more manageable than the risks that you're giving up. And it can really reduce the complexity. And I'll mention one other. In the report, we really push transparency as a way to reduce this complexity that you talk about. If I were doing the report again, I don't think I'd use the word transparency. We probably mean visibility or openness. And here's an example of what I mean. We've been talking for years about how to get software vendors to write better code for their devices. We talk about regulation, we talk about insurance, we talk about naming and shaming, we talk about legislation, we talk about all sorts of stuff. That's all really hard to get done right. Consumer Reports is going to start listing a cybersecurity rating alongside the other ratings in their magazine. So that if you're looking at a new phone, if you're looking at new electronic devices, if you're looking at a new connected refrigerator, there's going to be a rating for cybersecurity. Now, again, it might not be easy or cheap for Consumer Reports to get that right, but just think about how that's going to align market incentives and drive consumer behavior and drive what the vendors do. It's not going to need any new regulation. It's not going to need any new legislation. But that's what we're looking for. We're those places where we can use the smallest amount of effort that's going to align the market forces and lead to significantly more defensible cyberspace. And to me, that, again, I call it transparency, because it's a little bit of information to align these market incentives. And that's what we're really trying to get done with this in this report.
Then I'm sort of curious, then, where do we put sort of the business aspect and the risk management when it comes to defense? Because I think it was somebody who's, I was discussing it with somebody around the Target hack was, Target stock didn't really take a hit. And then when you discuss about all the other incumbent lawsuits that came afterwards, they basically amounted to maybe $100 million, $200 million, which, to somebody like Target, $100 million is nothing in a relative way. So, I mean, when we discuss risk management and the business side of things, how does that relate to the defense that we can build and sort of create?
Yeah, on one hand, I'm on one hand, I'm very pleased because we've got things like the SEC guidance. So your listeners might not know this, but a couple years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, the SEC came out with guidance that said, if your company has had a cyber incident or a cyber risk that's materially significant, and it's left up to the board to decide what materially significant is, you should tell your shareholders. It's six-page regulation. And to me, that's the kind of thing that as a public policy guy I like, because it's six pages. And it helped drive some of the right behavior so that we could at least start getting some of this transparency to the shareholders so that we can hold companies accountable. You're right. For Target, the effect on the share price was pretty minimal. JP Morgan's share price actually, I think, went up after in the weeks after their breach. But more importantly for Target, isn't what happened to the share price, is that people were losing their jobs, and directors and managers were being held accountable. I think Yahoo is potentially more significant in this, where you saw the share price less for $1 billion of shareholder value got wiped out because of that. So now that's driving behavior of board directors. It's driving behavior of people involved in M&As. The bankers and lawyers that are involved in mergers and acquisitions are now much more likely to get involved and ask the tough questions on cybersecurity and if the intellectual property has walked out the door. I think Equifax also, you're going to see this. I mean, the dismantlement of that as a business. So I think we're getting there, And to me, if I could convince one person in the world to take cybersecurity seriously, it wouldn't be the president of the United States, not this president, not previous presidents. It wouldn't be any chancellor or prime minister. It would be Warren Buffett. Because if I could convince Warren Buffett to take cyber risk seriously in the way that your question suggests, then I'm on the front of every business newspaper, every board director around the world is going to say, what's a NIST cybersecurity framework? How do I do this? Boy, Warren thinks that serious.
So I want to maybe talk about Equifax for a moment, because when we look at Equifax as a sort of risk, it seems like they had, consolidated a lot of personal data. And, I think a similar argument would apply to Transparent. I always forget the other two credit agencies. But, when we talk about defense, it seems like a simple innovation for Equifax would have been, taking mitigation seriously in the sense of, not storing all that personal data, and then B, sort of taking cybersecurity more seriously. But, how do we factor in companies that make their money purely on the storage and selling of data? It seems like that's a huge risk.
Yeah, on one hand, as focusing in public policy, I'm less concerned about individual companies, right? They're going to, they've got shareholders I meant to hold them responsible. And so for me as a public policy, I've got to have some concern about critical infrastructure, but I think that large, much of that is going to sort it. I want to find what are the best ways that I can help sort that out most smoothly. Certainly on Equifax, right? A lot of my transformative moments after I left the military were my time at Goldman Sachs, where you had Lloyd Blankfein, you had the other leadership of the company saying, up front, we know we're an IT company that happens to do finance. We know we've got to take cybersecurity seriously. And obviously, Equifax did not approach that the same way. When I talk to CFOs, especially in finance sector, about this, I phrase this as, this is a franchise-ending bet, right? In equities trading, stock trading, right? You talk about a long position where you own a lot of this stock. And I say, this is the longest position that this company owns, is this bet on information technology. And no way would your bank ever make this big, have owned this long a position with as little hedge as we've got. Your hedge right now is the small amount of money that you've spent in business continuity, on cybersecurity, on crisis management. And your firms are going to end as you know it. You will go bankrupt. You will stop, just like Lehman stopped, because of if things go wrong on the technology bets that you've made. And right, Equifax did not catch on that it could be the end of their company. If they don't take this seriously. Now again, that kind of language works very smoothly with finance companies, and so a lot of as I've been learning to communicate in this space is what's that right analogy for that board, for those managers, so they get this right. Right, saying data is the new oil doesn't quite get it there, but we need to help figure out the right ways for folks to figure out that this is the end of their business if they don't get it right. And now we're getting more and more examples of places where it is, where what motivates board directors is getting fired, of being embarrassed as a director, right? And if you're one of the Equifax board directors, and I heard the other day one of their board directors was, if I'm getting this right, was some former chairman or CEO of Citrix, the significant technology company. That guy's, people like that, their reputation is going to be trashed. Like, oh man, you're on the board of Equifax, and it's that kind of personal stuff that I think can really help drive the behavior on the boards.
So I want to maybe switch to sort of a general picture about the big players in this field. In the paper you referred to the U.S. government, the role of IT and cybersecurity companies, and the role of sort of IT-driven organizations. And I want to start with the U.S. government. And what I think a lot of people see as the big issue with the U.S. government, and that's consistency between administrations. So you might have sort of the Obama administration that might be interested in cybersecurity, and then you have the Trump administration that, I mean, for all its controversies, I sort of struggled in trying to find, you know, other than, you know, trying to find a sort of concrete thought or document on cybersecurity from the Trump administration. Maybe, you know, you know, as a public policy guy, you might know better. But, I mean, how do we, you know, deal with that? The consistency between administrations, you know, the consistency between Congresses on cybersecurity.
Yeah, there has been pretty significant continuity with this administration and the previous. The main thing that this administration has done, Executive Order 3800, you know, could easily have been written by a Democratic administration if the election would have gone differently. And by the way, the 13800, that new executive order, is very much in line with our New York Cyber Task Force, with the New York Cyber Task Force, right? I mean, it's pushing shared services, which is DC speak for cloud. It talks about moving more to a single cybersecurity framework, in particular the NIST cybersecurity framework. It talks about a lot of stuff that is about defensible cyberspace. It doesn't surprise me. Tom Bossert, the Homeland Security Advisor, that was the primary person pushing that. You know, we'd talk to him about the work and the Atlanta Council work that it was rooted in. And when we briefed him on it, it was great. He had his little blue highlighter out, and he was highlighting a lot of these innovations in the center of the report. And so there has been continuity in general, even back to the first president that started taking this seriously in Bill Clinton, through Bush, through Obama, and now kind of the fourth president. You can see the kind of continuity going through.
Interesting. So then in your view, what is the government's, you know, most effective form of leverage?
Yeah.
I mean, is it a matter of regulations and laws, or is it a matter of sort of funding and sort of the government being able to take a loss but creating intellectual property? What is the government's main advantage?
Great question. It's certainly true in cyber conflict, and it's more generally true for cybersecurity. And this is a lesson that goes back to my book, which was, it was astounding as we went back and we looked at cyber conflicts, in that almost none of the major cyber conflicts or major cyber crises had been decisively resolved by government, any government, ever. The few times where the governments were decisive was when it was the governments themselves that were under attack. You know, for example, like Operation Buckshot Yankee or espionage against government. When the attack has been much larger, like the Conficker malware that hit a couple of years ago, or WannaCry or the rest, it's always, and I pretty much mean always, the private sector that has the dominant role in the response, in stopping the bad activity that's just happened. And so, to tie this into how that actually happens. So in cyber crises, it's the private sector that has the agility, the subject matter expertise, and they have their hands deep in cyberspace. And what I mean by that, one of my former colleagues from my time in the military, a guy named Mark Sachs, he used to work for Verizon. And he said, Jay, remember, at Verizon, we're creating and maintaining cyberspace every day. We can bend it if we need to. And I love that phrase of the private sector can bend cyberspace if it's needed to help the defense. Government can't do any of that. Government stinks at agility. They don't have enough subject matter expert, and they certainly don't have that ability to bend cyberspace, at least Western governments. But what governments do bring is they bring massive resources, at least most governments, certainly the U.S. government. Tied to that is staying power. And also they bring access to other levers of power, and you've got the bully pulpit of the president to get up and speak about it. You've got diplomacy, demarches, raising people up on charges, indicting them, or, you know, the military, you know, stabbing them in sleep, right? I mean, that's something that governments can do and is difficult for the private sector to do. And so the best solutions are those that can bring that agility, subject matter expertise, and the ability to change cyberspace with those strengths of the government, the resources, the staying power, and the access to other levers of power. So we're always on the lookout, especially for me in public policy. What are those spaces where we can do that, where you can bring these kinds of things to bear?
So then, I mean, in terms of boundaries, you know, what can sort of, you know, maybe let me reframe the question. When should a private company sort of rely on the government, and when shouldn't it? Because it seems like you have something like WannaCry that was, if I remember correctly, was attacking hospitals, you know, and essentially
attacking everybody, yeah.
Yeah. You know, infrastructure. I mean, when is it appropriate for, you know, a hospital or a private entity to sort of cross the line and say, we need government help, or, you know,
but
to invite the
government?
What's
government going to do, right? I mean, to me, right. And it's a good question. But at the end of the day, I like to flip that around and say, well, what the hell can government actually do? And so you end up with this, well, what can they do? And then you got to match that across of, okay, what can we, when is it okay to ask them for different things? Because if we only look at the, when people ask that only and when can companies ask the government for help, you end up with a certain set of answers that government can't possibly live up to. They don't have the capacity, they don't have the authorities, and frankly, we don't want them to have the authorities to do those things. And so I like to where I start, I end up with, so rather than answer it, let me say, here's a way that helped me come up with my own answers. And so that you and the listeners to this can use this as the thought experiment to help them as they come up with their own answers to this. I like to flip it around and say, all right, imagine that America is at cyber war, that a nation state is using cyber capabilities. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of casualties from this. We're clearly looking to DHS to solve us from this, but it's now the military. And you know, you can imagine that there is not a kinetic element to this yet. Like, we're not rolling tanks across the border, but, you know, treat this just as a thought experiment that we're now in cyber war. What now is the government going to be doing? So you can say, all right, well, clearly if we're in that space, then the military needs to be attacking back the attacks. Well, how does that happen? Imagine the attacks are against the finance sector. And if the attacks don't stop by 8 p.m. tonight, then the banks aren't going to be able to clear and settle in time, and they're not going to be able to open in the morning. Well, how does that information get from the finance sector to the Department of Defense so the Department of Defense knows what they need to do? You know, in national security terms, it's call for fires, right? So how does that call for fires go from whom in the finance sector to whom in the Department of Defense? Or imagine it's the energy sector and in the electricity grid. How do we get intelligence from the private sector defenders, I mean, to the private sector defenders? And that's the tear line, right? Not just something that gets declassified through some lengthy process that then gets handed to DHS, that they then send as a tear line to the banks. How do you include the private sector that are now going to be in that, you know, the forward edge of the battle area? How do we include them into every aspect of the intelligence cycle? How do they submit requirements, because they're the ones that are actually fighting the battle? How does that get submitted? How do we run through the full cycle all the way through dissemination and feedback to make sure that they're able to win the war? And right, and you start walking through this, and now that's, maybe this is only applicable at real cyber war, but at least it's a thought experiment that you can, all right, well, what if it's not fully cyber war? What if it's just are really, what if it's a little bit not quite so bad, and then a little bit not quite so bad as that, and a little bit not quite so bad as that. And instead of imagining things as they are today and imagining they're a little bit worse, start working your way down. I call it black and white. It's tough to answer these questions now because it's so murky to try and figure out what the government should do to help. And any time we just say, well, imagine it's a little bit worse, all we're doing is we're turning on our high beams in that fog. And turning on your high beams in the fog just means you get to see more fog. So I like imagining that place where it's really black and white, and then imagining that clarity and how far down that clarity extends. And at some point, you're going to meet in the middle. And so whenever we hit those questions, let's start flipping that question around to ways that are more answerable. Let's pick the most answerable end border case, and then figure out how much use we get out of that.
So I maybe want to, for my last question, discuss something that's not in the paper, which is in your paper. It's very much sort of network defense, right? Where you're gonna, this is how you defend the network. This is how you defend cyberspace. But I think in the last year or so, with the Brexit campaign, with the 2016 U.S. election, yep. We saw sort of, you don't have to be, you don't have to be a Metasploit magician to be effective at hacking. And what I'm trying to focus on is, where do we factor in sort of broadly the intersection of social media and society, and more specific, how do we integrate Facebook and Twitter into this? Because, they were hacked, but reading through the papers, the DHS paper and all this, it really seems like, whoever was attacking was using Facebook as intended or using Twitter as intended. So where do we factor in social media companies?
We really messed up. When I got into this field in the 90s, we were all talking about information operations and information warfare. Hacking was just one part of that, but also counter-propaganda influence and the rest. We would have been much, much better equipped for what the Russians did to us in 1999 than in 2016. Much, much better equipped. And it was really 2004 when the offense mission for cyber got assigned to NSA that we just forgot about information operations and focused on the cool technical cyber thing. We banished info ops to National Defense University and then we forgot about National Defense University. And so it's without a doubt, it's incredibly difficult. But we just got really dumb in the U.S. government. My solutions tend to go down a couple different ways. The solutions that I like best, specific to social media, are looking at the money and what we can do to control the flow of money. Right, a lot of these issues deal with how the companies have monetized attention. And one of my favorite examples was one of the banks, I believe it was J.P. Morgan, was getting complaints. Their ads were popping up, maybe not on Daily Stormer, but some sites that were exceptionally questionable. And they decided that they were going to go to whitelist advertising and say, we're only going to advertise on this list of, say, 400 sites. And they found that they spent less money on ads, and they got a higher click-through rate. And so, to me, those kinds of solutions, those where we're looking at changing the monetary ecosystem, especially on the fake news, on the fake news sites, the deliberate sites that are producing fake news, like those that are coming out of Eastern Europe. If more companies are doing that, then we can hopefully starve some of them of the money that they need, and we can do that without getting into these tough questions about what is fake news, right? Just by companies deciding on their advertising spend that we might be able to make gains in things like that. Now, within government and tying it to cyber, It's very, very difficult for U.S. government in any shape in this, right? It should be anyone other than the Department of Defense that's in charge of countering adversary influence. DoD is just not the right agency for that. It should be someone like State. But with the way State's cutting headcount right now and mission, there's not much that we can expect there. The kinds of ideas that I've been liking most is where can we use DoD in easier ways for parts of the problem. So what the North Koreans did, what the Russians did, was they hacked, and then they used the fruits of that hack for influence campaigns. So to me, right now at U.S. Cyber Command, we've got the Cyber Mission Force, right? So we've got this dedicated group of up to 6,000, you know, of their probably around 6,000 people now on their way to 6,200. And you've got Russia experts and China experts and North Korea experts and Iran experts sitting next to cyber experts. We could add something like cyber influence teams as a new part of the cyber mission. And they are there to look at when our adversaries are using cyber capabilities as part of influence operations. So that when they see, wait a minute, why are the Russians hacking this target? Is it espionage, or are they going to try and weaponize this information? And they are specifically there to try and track that kind of activity and feed its way up through the DoD chain to the White House. Now, again, they shouldn't be the only ones. There should also be folks working at State and across the national security enterprise. But to me, it's most solvable within the Department of Defense as a near-term thing.
So I'm sort of curious about, as a matter of public policy and sort of skill set development. And the story I want to tell is when I was getting into InfoSec and working at Help Desk, I had a mentor in D.C. And I said, you know, this SEO and how sort of search engines index stuff is really cool. And she said, you know, what you really want to do is get into forensics, like, offense, defense, and sort of that field, because, you know, that's where the future is. And now that was in, I think, 2013. And then, you know, in 2016, I have debates with people on Twitter, discussions about how, you know, we for the last 10 years, we focused on building tech skills. And it turns out, much to your point, that, you know, those humanity skills, the language skills, cultural, are just as needed. So when we talk about public policy and sort of skill development at the university level or at sort of the self-teaching level, I mean, should we be integrating more of the humanities and sort of, I loathe this phrase, but I'm going to say it, the soft skills? Or
Yeah, without a doubt. The, you know, one of my big conversations I've had in this was a woman named Bobby Stempley. And she had been, in the late 90s, I was working with her when she was running the Department of Defense Computer Emergency Response Team. I mean, a hardcore tech. And then she was a deputy secretary at DHS. And she was like, oh, man, the way she tells it, like, I'm going to eat these policy folks alive because they don't know nothing. And I'm this, you know, this hardcore tech ninja. And it's wonderful to hear her tell it because she doesn't understand anything of what's going on, because policy is a different kind of thing. And even though she knows these great technical solutions, she doesn't understand how to get those solutions implemented within D.C., that even if they may make sense technically, they might not make sense for other reasons. And she explores how she makes her way around that to know what the public policy tools are, right? And I work for an international affairs public policy school, so I'm dealing with this every day, you know, where I'm trying to mostly get these folks that don't understand the technology and help them to understand the technology as best they can, so that they can look at different solutions. All of my best conversations have been with people like Richard Bate, like Dmitry Alperovich or Jeff Moss, who have said, I know I can't make a difference. There's only a limited difference I can make on the technology anymore. I've so they've said they have to start getting involved on the policy side as well. Now, one of my favorite, and here's an example of what I can mean if we come at this from a public policy lens, right? If you've got a problem of botnets or the DDoS attacks that come from it, technology solutions say, all right, we'll try and measure it. We'll try and go to folks and try and get these, you know, the DDoS networks down. We'll try and control BCP 38 or network time protocol, and work through the technology plane. From a policy side, you can say, what does cap and trade look like? You know, if you run a network connected to the internet, you're allowed to have this much botnet pollution, and if you go above this level, then you're going to get taxed above that level. You've got to buy a license from someone else that runs a cleaner network. Right? It's a different way of thinking about the same problem, but it gives you this much, much broader tool set.
So I think with that, we've covered a lot today. And as always, before you leave, leave us with some closing thoughts, something to chew on, something to sort of consider.
Well, I think if I can leave you with something, it might be on this last point of this over this connection between technology and policy. I think especially for your listeners, we have a series of events, and it's called the Cyber 9/12 Student Challenge. And so the next one is going to be coming up in March at American University in Washington, D.C. And it is we bring together students. It is the largest national security cyber policy competition. That is, the students are here to come together to fast-breaking cyber incident to say, Mr. President, no one has yet died from this cyber attack, so it's too early to think about NATO Article 5, but we can consider sanctions, NATO Article 4, and here are some options for covert action. So it's not a hacking competition, but it's the students coming together to dive in onto the policy side. And we call it Cyber 9/12 because most of us that do cyber, we roll our eyes when we hear Cyber 9/11 or Cyber Pearl Harbor. So we decided, let's make that mean something. Not what happens on Cyber 9/11, but what happens the day after. How do you respond to this very bad cyber incident? And so I'm pleased to announce that Deborah Lee James, the former Secretary of the Air Force, is the chair of the Cyber 9/12 Student Challenge this year. And so we're expecting a really great competition. Last year we had 46, expect more this year. We're also in 2018 going to be having competitions in London, I think in February as well. It's going to be the first year in London, and I believe our fourth year in Geneva, Switzerland. We also had one last in October in Sydney, Australia, and we'll be popping around hopefully for some other events around the globe.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's so cool. Of course, sure thing.